Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Christine Williams.
And you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for people who play with needles.
Indeed.
And what'd you drag us into? Or it's also people who love people who... What was that?
Yes, and the people who love people who play with needles.
To broaden our audience.
I'm just trying to open up. Yeah. I'm just trying to open it up, you know?
Yeah. Okay, fine.
Have other people understand. That's all.
You're such a humanitarian. It touches my heart.
I didn't say it was going to work. I just, you know, was saying.
All right. Okay, our guest this week. Hi, Debbie. Debbie Woodward from the Painted Pony Designs. Hi, Debbie.
Hi, y'all. How are you doing?
Doing okay.
So we were just talking about the use of y'all and how much pleasure it gives me. So thank you for that.
You're welcome.
So, Debbie... Painted Pony Designs, if anybody doesn't know them, they certainly know the little angel canvases. Because are there like 1,000 of those now, or what's the deal?
Well, it seems like it, but there's really we've designed about 400, maybe a little more than 400, but we have discontinued about 50 over the last 3 years. So somewhere above 350 is where we are right now.
All right, well, before we get into anything else, how did that get started? I mean, it seems to me like that started and grew into a monster. I mean, that's huge.
It did, and I am really lucky and blessed that I came up with that little design, because it has provided us many meals over the years. I was about my second year into showing at the TNNA market. And, of course, when you go to TNNA, it's real important that you bring all your new things to market and have new things. And I remember kind of trying to rack my brains, what could I bring to market that second year that I was there? Because I'd had a really good first year. And one of the things that was a hot collectible at the time was this little seashell-type angel. And I'm sure y'all have seen these little angels made out of seashells. And I was just real intrigued with them. And so I sat down one day and just started playing with the shape and came up with that angel shape that's iconic to Painted Pony now. And anyway, I showed about 8 angels at the first market. In fact, we don't even have those 8 angels in the line anymore, because they were extremely basic angels. It was like, basically, here's a blue one with dots, here's a yellow one with dots, here's a whatever. And we had at that market was something that they used to have called the Needlepoint Galleria. And you rented a little panel and you had a little wine and cheese kind of thing the night before the show. And I had rented a panel and I put my little 8 angels on it. And people kept coming by and looking at them, telling them how much they loved them. Well, it was amazing. The next morning, the show opened at 10 o'clock and I was still fluffing up my booth. I had my back to the aisle, and I turned around, and there were dozens of people standing outside my booth ready to come in and order those angels. And I was literally mobbed for hours that first
day.
That
is so great. Yeah.
I know, and I've never had that experience since. I mean, I've always had people, you know, show up, but just it was an amazing experience. And the angels were born at that point.
That's neat. Now, are there... I just see the angels, but and I haven't never stitched one. Are there 2 sizes, or what do you have now?
Well, the basic angel that most people stitch and collect is it's about 5.5 inches long, about 5.5 inches wide, and that's the one that we have about 350 currently different designs for. There is one that we call the mini angel. It's about 3 inches. Oh, I guess 3.25 by 3.25. It has a flat bottom, and we just did kind of mini versions of some of our bigger ones. And then what really sells is that we went off into designing some with university logos. I mean, not logos, but like their name, like eagles or whatever.
That's cool. Yeah.
And we also got the licensing for the sorority and fraternity canvases, and in those angels we have one for, oh gosh, maybe 20 sororities. And that is where they really, that's what we mostly sell in the mini angels, are those groups of those series.
So you actually took the time and made the effort to get fully licensed so you could use the official colors and shapes of logos and everything.
Well, for the sororities, yes, because the sororities actually even claim their lettering, like their, you know, if it's like Pi Beta Phi and those three Greek letters, those are actually copyrighted by the different sororities. So you can't use any kind of sorority lettering unless you have a license. And so there's a big giant licensing group out of New York, and that's where we get our licensing through.
Oh, okay.
The college ones are very generic. They could almost be for your high school. You know, there's nothing on them that would be copyrightable by the colleges. It's just, you know, here's a black and red one, and it's got the word eagle on it, and so mm-hmm. it could fit any school.
Hmm. So I can see a lot of moms doing those.
Yeah. Do most people finish them as stand-ups?
For the mini ones, I have seen stand-ups, but I think mostly they're a really nice little Christmas tree ornament size, and most of what I have seen on Facebook and Pinterest has been a hanging ornament.
Okay. Huh. Mm-hmm. Now, are those – okay, I mean, I just got to know. So are those all hand-painted, or are you to the point now where you just have to send them out and have somebody – stamp paint them, or I don't know how it goes. I mean, that's because you move a lot of those things, far as I can tell.
Yes, everything that we produce is hand painted. We use a painting service, and then I actually have two ladies here in Texas that do a lot of our work for us.
Holy smokes, that's a lot of painting.
It is.
It is, and it's big bills when I get inboxes from my painters. They're just like, I never dreamed that I would owe somebody multi-thousands of dollars, you know, every week. So it's kind of humbling when you think that I started out as a kitchen painter, literally a kitchen table painter, literally painting my little orders on a kitchen table, and we have grown to the size that we are now.
It's great is what it is. Cause I was reading your bio or whatever it is on the website. And this all started because the store you were at, they wanted you to do a couple of designs for Christmas in July. Is that?
Yes. I always tell everybody I accidentally got into this business. I had been a graphic designer after I had graduated from college in Houston, and my husband lived in Austin. And we got married about, 6 years after college. We got married, and my father had died right before we got engaged, and my whole family, it was very, you know, it was just hard. Daddy was about 47 years old, so it was sort mm-hmm. of a shock.
Yeah.
And anyway, my family needed a lot of love and support. And when I moved to Austin, my husband said he had a really good job, and we were doing well as a young couple. And he said, take a year off and, you know, take care of yourself, take care of your family. Well, during that time period, I'd already been cross stitching and a little bit of needlepoint. And I was just cross stitching ourselves. Broke is what was happening. It was like every Saturday I was off to the stores and off to, you know, the craft stores, and I was just literally breaking us. And he wasn't complaining, but I felt kind of bad about it. So there was a little cross stitch and quilt shop that I often went to, and they were looking for some help. And so I started working for them. And then after a year, I switched over to another larger general shop, and then I'd been there with them for about a year, and then a shop in town was familiar with my graphic arts ability since I'd been a graphic artist for several years, and asked me to design their logos and all their branding products. And so I did, and that store is called The Needleworks. It's in Austin. They still use my logo and my branding products and the ones that I designed. Anyway, after I did that, the two ladies that own that store asked me if I would like to come work part-time and also do occasional custom work for them. And so I went over there, and that's really how I got to learn decorative stitches and the new fibers. It was a real exciting time to get into mm-hmm. needlepoint, because kind of the years before, it was just all the Patternaean yarn and the basket weave, and I kind of came in at the point where the decorative stitches were starting to be explored, and and, you know, people were using linen threads to make tree bark and, you know, and overdyed thread, you know, to do the skies and the trees. And it was just a real exciting time, a big time of change in needlepoint. And so anyway, at that point, I guess we had lived there about 4 years, and we moved over to the Gulf Coast. And I had, oh, it was in like May or June, they called and they said, hey, we're going to do our annual Christmas in July, and would you like to show a line there? And I was like, well, I don't have a line. So,
a little so problem. Sure.
There's no line. So I sat down, and at that time, the Southwest Southwest designs were real popular. And so I did some coyotes, and then I did some mini socks, because mini socks were always or have always been big. And I, you know, just one Saturday, I took it all with me and went up there to kind of be like a featured designer that day, and sold almost everything. I had made several copies of everything, sold almost everything, came home with very little. And plus I came home with orders because people who couldn't get, who lost out on buying the pieces placed orders. And that's how we were born. And, before I got there, they had, of course, wanted to advertise my name. And I was just thinking that this was a fun weekend. I was going to go up and see my little shop owner friends, and we were just going to have a good old time. And, so I didn't really have any, I really had no plans beyond that weekend and no real fantasies of starting a line. So when I came up with the name, I love horses. I've loved them since I was 2 years old. I've always wanted one. So I thought, I'll just take whatever money we make and I will create a horse fund for it. So that's how the name Painted Pony came about, because that's what I was going to do with my money. Mm-hmm. Was I going to paint, buy a pony when it was all over. Well, we got so busy so fast that it was 10 years before we ever bought the horse.
But you did buy the horse.
We did buy the horse. I disguised him as a gift for my daughter.
Oh, that's a good scam. That's a good scam, yes.
It was. It was a good scam. And she rode from, oh, I think she was 10 when we got him. And she rode all the way through right until the end of high school, early college. And then she went off to the University of Texas. Yay, hook 'em. And she didn't ride him much after that. So he's pretty much just been a glorified pet in our backyard, and doesn't think he owes us anything. He just, you know, hangs out in the backyard and talks to the cows over the fence.
Well, that's neat that he's there, because, you know, I was going to ask you, is it boarded at some barn somewhere? Is right? You have enough property to be right in the yard then, huh?
Well, we have 2 acres, and we're on the first, I would guess we're on the first, two-thirds of the acre, and then he has the other acre and a third.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, this animal that does nothing but costs us money also has the majority of our property as well.
Outstanding. Now, I do have to
work that really well.
Yeah, I have to inject here. Next week's show, I just want to promote next week's show. Dr. Phil is going to join us, and we're going to talk to people who have cross-stitched their families into bankruptcy. So Debbie will be back next week.
That's right. And I will need intensive therapy for all the money I've spent. Yes.
It'll be an 8-hour show. We'll have 47 guests.
Yes. Yeah, that'll be the problem, getting the guests down to a reasonable number. Yes.
Exactly.
So this just took off on you, and it sounds like you were playing catch up for a while.
I was doing work. I was filling orders only for this one store, and that was from whenever they had their Christmas in July promotion until sometime in the fall. And one of my sister-in-laws lived up in Houston, and at that time we were living about an hour south of Houston. And we just had made arrangements one Saturday to go eat lunch at a little German place that was a real popular little sandwich place up in River Oaks at the time. And I drove up there, and I told her, I said, I'm going to be brave, because this is not my thing. I'm not necessarily the warrior that I would hope to be. And I said, I'm going to be brave, and I'm going to go down by we're going to go over to a needlepoint shop in town, and I'm just going to give them my card, and I have a bunch of my photos of my designs and see if they're interested. So she and I stopped into the Needle House, which is a store down in Houston that's still in business. And at that time, the owner was named Susan Deaton. So I asked if Susan was there, and she wasn't. She was gone, either running errands or out to lunch or something. So I just casually asked where, how we got to this restaurant from the Needle House, and got directions, and we left. So Susie, my sister-in-law, and I are sitting in a restaurant, and we, and all of a sudden this lady comes up to the table, and she says, "Are you Debbie Woodard from Painted Pony Designs?" And we're like, "Whoa, what is happening?" This is not normal. And I said, "Yes." And she said, "I am Susan. I have been looking for you for months, trying to find out who you are and how I could get a hold of you." And she sat down at the table, and I had the pictures in my purse, so I showed her the pictures, and she placed an order right there.
Wow.
And so that's when she had told me that her customers had been going to Austin, picking up our little designs and bringing them back for threads or to stitch or to get them finished. And she kept seeing them over and over and over again. And she was like, "Who is this person that's doing this?" And so anyway, so she was my second account, and she placed a really nice order at lunch. And at that time we decided that maybe we needed to try to go to our first, market. And it, and back in those times, this would have been about 1990. There was a very nice little cash and carry market that was up in Dallas called the Dallas Needlework Market. So we went in February, designed several more canvases. I think maybe I brought 35 or 40 designs to that show. And we sold, we really almost sold everything. We came home with a ton of orders. And so it was, the accidental business was born.
Well, that's the thing is, you take a bunch of stuff to a show and sell it and then come home with more orders. I mean, that's like a double win.
Well, yes. And of course, every designer hopes to come home from markets with orders, because we have to make it from, you know, most of these markets are 4 and 5 months in between. And we've got to have some way to make some money in between the shows. So you do live for orders in between the markets.
So how, describe your operation. I'm fascinated by this painted canvas business, and especially all hand painted. So your husband works in the business, and who do you have that works with you immediately? And then you have painting services outside, that's all they do. How does this all work?
The way that our company is set up is, as far as for the Painted Pony line, I'm the only designer for that. And those, so I design every angel. I design anything else that's under the Painted Pony banner. We have a lot of Christmas and holiday, a sleigh set, a nativity, Southwest nativity set. There's several other things we have, besides the angels. And then, we also rep for about 10 other designers, where, some of them were needlepoint designers who have given up their lines for whatever reason, and we took some of those lines over. And then in the last 2.5 years, we've actually been going and finding fine artists and developing their designs into needlepoint canvas. We keep the operation small, so that we can keep the profit margin somewhat enough to help us out. If you were to come over and see my little workspace, there is, in my space, there is myself, and I am pretty much everything. I am the janitor. I am the designer. I am the shipper. You know, if you name it, I do it. And then my husband, John, who is a minister full-time, he works for us. He claims that he works full-time for Painted Pony as well, and he probably does. He's our bookkeeper. He took that over several years ago. I couldn't do it. I just couldn't do everything. And the worst, you know, I was not a math major. I was an art major. And so, it was kind of time to allow someone to come in and, take over, the accounting and all that kind of stuff. So he does all that, and he does the collections and all that kind of stuff.
I'm always interested in the secret lives of ministers, because I think a lot of them have something else going on like that. That's interesting.
I feel bad for him, because during his ministry time, he's like the good guy out there doing good work, and then he comes home and calls people for, you know, like, "Hey, you haven't paid your bills." So two different personalities, I guess. I mean, he's not mean or anything, but he does have to get on to some of the shops every once in a while that have gotten a little bit behind. and also in our day to day, we have a part-time employee who works about 24 hours a week, and she is totally in charge of my trunk shows, as well as she does a little bit of inventory control and filing and things like that. We run about 4 trunk shows a month. Until last year, we ran 5 and 6 a month, but it was just overwhelming, and it just seemed like that was what our whole life was about, was taking in trunk shows and putting them back out. So we cut it back to 4 this year, and it's still kind of a big job, but at least it's not 5 or 6 a month. And anyway, but it keeps her very busy. She is constantly working on trunk shows and getting them prepped for the next round to go out.
Yeah. Take us through the mechanics of the trunk show. I mean, I know what it's like at the store, but take us through mm-hmm. the mechanics of that, because that's an interesting aspect of this business.
Yes, it is very time consuming. We do our trunk shows a certain way. We, instead of just grabbing what's on the shelves, putting it in a box, sending it off and hoping it sells, we look at QuickBooks and we look at what sells the best for us. And that's what we pull and keep. We keep a standard inventory for all. We have, I think we have 6 different trunk shows, and we keep a standard inventory for every one of them. And then we kind of pack it with anything regional. So like if you're on the coast in Florida, then we put in a lot of beach stuff, that kind of a thing. It depends on the show what the wholesale and the retail values are. Our Painted Pony, our bestseller shows, are very large and have hundreds of canvases in them. Smaller show might be our Mary Engelbright, because it's a totally her line, but she only has about 120 designs. So it's a little smaller, manageable show. So it just kind of depends on what you're working with. Like I said earlier, we have several shows. We have the bestseller, and that is basically the top 20 or 25 canvases from each line that we distribute for, except we add a lot of extra angels and we add a lot of extra PD Santas in that. And then we have a Painted Pony show, which is your standard one-line type of show, and it has about 125 angels in it. And then we have, let's see, what else do we have? We have what is a new show for us is the Fine Arts show, and that's where we took all of our artists that we developed lines for, you know, people who are not needlepoint designers. And we have a big giant, it's turned into a huge line, a huge show, because we put all of their canvases from their lines into it. So it's become really big. Then we have the Mary Engelbright show, and we have a PD show. And the PD show and the Mary Engelbright show are standard one line type shows.
This is much more than I thought it was. I thought you just put together a bunch of canvases and shipped them off to a store, but you really put some sophistication to this thing.
Yeah, we thought it out, and we came up with I think we'd start out with 4 different shows about 3 years ago, and then as we've added the fine artists, we've changed it up a little bit, and anyway, yes, we thought it out. It was that way we could actually have trunk shows in the same region, but they don't compete with each other, except that they're 2 trunk shows, you know, competing with each other. But if you've got a Mary Engelbright show and a Petey show within 200 miles of each other, they're not competing canvas with mm-hmm. each other. So it actually helps us kind of get out all over the country all the time, every month. When we put these shows together, like I said, we have a standard list that we go to, and we pull and try to keep everything in stock. We pull the canvases and we prep them. We put a header on them. We have found through the years that if we put a header across the top, it keeps the canvases from getting less damage. There's no pinholes or thumbtacks that get into them. Keeps the life of the canvas a little bit longer. And we have a standard inventory sheet, and it's a check-in sheet that the store checks it in and then reports to us anything that we've overlooked or forgot or whatever happened to it, or if there's a damaged canvas. They have to let us know before the show starts. And anyway, so it's very it, it's very time consuming. And like I said, we do it four times a month, putting them out, and then they all come back in, and they usually come back in around the fifth or sixth of the month. And we have to get them all checked back in, make sure everything that was reported as sold is missing, and everything that missing is accounted for.
Just logistically, that's a lot. So
it is. Yes. Yeah. And it's why I have an employee that does nothing but that. And I did forget to tell you, I do, in Painted Pony, we do have we've just recently hired a second employee, and she's going to be covering our shipping and invoicing and answering the phone. And she's a trainee. We just started training her this week, but hopefully she likes it, because I really can't afford her not to like it. I need her really bad.
I have to understand here. So when you say four trunk shows a month, is that simply four? So like across the country, there are only four stores each month that have one of your trunk shows? Or is it four of these packages that go out to multiple stores?
No, it's four shows a month across the country that have a show. The shows could be different. Some months we have two bestsellers out, and some months we only have one bestseller out in every other thing. We also have, you know, and if there is one bestseller, there's also a Painted Pony show out at the same time. That's the way it works. And then if there's a Petey show out, then we don't have a Mary Engelbreit. If there's a Mary Engelbreit out, we don't have a Petey. We have it all figured out so that basically every show is out every other month, except that we have bestseller shows every month.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you're covering all the canvases, but you're not stepping on your own sales.
Yes, and we're real careful not to step on our own sales. It hurts the shops, and it hurts us in the end as well. So, yeah. So these shops, you know, we make sure that if we have a Painted Pony show in California, the bestseller show is in the Midwest or on the East Coast, and we're real careful about scheduling that.
Wow. So the person who handles all this must have a map on the wall with pins all over the place.
Yeah, well, we kind of do. We do have a schedule that we keep current all the time. And whenever somebody calls in for a trunk show, the first thing we do is kind of look 3 or 4 months ahead and 3 or 4 months out to see if anyone in that state is also has some kind of show. We want to make sure that the same canvases are not going in the region at the same time. And then, of course, when you get over to the East Coast, the states are a little bit smaller. So sometimes you have to say, now, what are you close to? Because we don't always know, you know, how far apart the stores are. You know, if you're in Texas, which we don't schedule similar shows in Texas, but everything in Texas is 3.5 or 4 hours away. So, you know, if you have a Petey and a Mary Engelbreit in Houston and Dallas, they don't affect each other, really.
Yeah, but where Christine lives, you could have in four different states, and it's still. Well,
yeah, I mean, from here, Jersey, Connecticut, they're all within 2 hours easily. So,
yeah, it's funny. I was this last weekend. I was at the Destination Dallas market, and somebody came in, and they were asking me how far. I had said something about going to see my daughter, and they said, "How far away is she?" And I said, 6 hours, and she said, "Well, is that way out in West Texas?" I said, "Yes." I said, "But it's at the beginning of West Texas." And she said, "Well, where's the end?" And I said, "El Paso." And she said, "Well, how far is that from San Angelo? That's where my daughter lives." And I said, "Oh, it's another 9 hours." She goes, "Well, and where do you live?" And I said, "I live about an hour west of the Louisiana border." And she's like, "How far is that?" And I was like, "Well, it's, let me see, 9 hours and 6 hours more." I said, "I guess it's about 16 hours. And she goes, "Like in miles." And it was real funny, because then I had to do math to find out how many miles we were. And I came up with something around 930 miles, which I think is pretty close to how wide Texas is. But I had just read when I got home a joke about how Texans always talk about how far everything is in hours. We don't talk about miles. That's what I was doing to her. And she was like all confused. I kept saying, "Oh, yeah, you know, it's like 9 hours away and everything." But it's a big state, and that's how we do our mileage, is by hours and not by actual miles.
I'm curious about this fine artist thing. Talk about how that came to be and what's involved there.
Okay. As I said, my first four designers that I started distributing for were all needlepoint. They'd all been needlepointers in their past lives. And so they had, for whatever reasons, had decided not to continue with their lines. And so I had contacted them and picked them up. And then as time went by, I kind of looked and at my line, and there were just things that were missing, certain kinds of themes and certain kind of styles that were missing. So I knew that every once in a while somebody would go out and find like a Warren Kimball, and they would license him, and they would put those designs in their line. So I started kind of looking around in the art world to see who was out there. And my first two designers that I contacted, one was Diane Ulmer Pedersen, and she is a folk artist out of Massachusetts. And the second was Lynn Andrews, and she's actually a decorative painter. She does a lot of tulle painting books and that kind of thing. And she's out of Rhode Island. So I contacted them, and they were both excited about it. So we took the designs, and we we just had them painted on needlepoint canvas, and that's how we got started. And then my third artist that I added was a real coup for us, and that was Mary Engelbright. And how that came about was a couple of her fans. She had been talking about maybe getting back into needlepoint. She had apparently had some bad experiences with some needlepoint designers in the past. And they were asking her if she would ever get back in. And she said, if I can find somebody that I, trustworthy, then I'll get back in. And they said, and I don't know why they picked me, but they said both of them, and this was separate conversations, both recommended me. So one of them found out that the other had done it, and so she called me and told me that I should call Mary Engelbright. So I thought, well, what do you lose? I mean, it's just a phone call. So I called her up, and well, I didn't call her. I called one of her assistants up and explained who I was, and I guess maybe in 20 minutes we had decided to do a deal. Now the deal took about 4 months to put together, but we had I've never had that experience since, but it is a very extensive contract, and they know exactly what they're doing. I mean, that is a well-functioning company, and anyway, so we were able to take some of her designs, and we painted those onto needlepoint canvas, and it's just been a very successful project for us, and we're really proud that we have that Mary Engelbright line, because she's so iconic and so many people know.
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Then even just the name is recognizable, right? So just that.
Yes. It's cool. It's cool to have that. It's cool to have that line in our brand. Anyway, and then we just started adding some other designers. We picked up a line called Mary Charles, and she is a fine artist out of Lancaster, and her stuff is just, if you love folk art, you are just going to be crazy about Mary Charles. And she has been a super hit since we put her out. Her stuff is just gorgeous, and there's people starting clubs on her and classes and all that kind of stuff. And it was real cute because one of the stores that's in Lancaster is called Stitches Unlimited. And they were real excited to see one of her barns because it was a barn that's recognizable in in that county. And so they wanted to start a class. And anyway, I mentioned it to her that they were doing this class, and she actually went and visited the store. They got to see her and meet her. Uh-huh. And it was just a real good experience for that store. And they're actually starting their second round of classes on that same canvas in October. And then after that, we picked up, recently we picked up two artists. One is Diane Cater. She's kind of like a Mary Engelbright. She does a lot of card and gift type designs. And she's been really popular. We did really well with her at Destination Dallas. That was the first time we had cash and carry on her, and we did really good. And then the other artist was one that she lived in England, and she lives in England, and we contacted her, and we only did about 8 of her designs. I love them. I knew that I loved them. I wasn't sure how they would be received because it's very soft and very it was just not the typical folk art type of thing. It was very soft and pale, and I wasn't sure. Well, I should have been more sure because she was a mega hit at the June show. Everybody was ordering her stuff, and we'd only had 8 canvases there, and it was on every order we took. Somebody was ordering. Her name is Sally Fwinell. The cute thing about talking to Sally, we do everything over the internet, over email, but we don't understand each other. She doesn't always understand my Texas phrasing. And one time she said something about, she said, oh, I have this really cute design and we use it for jotters. And I'm like, what's a jotter? And I didn't want to seem like an idiot not know what a jotter is. Finally, she kept talking about jotters and I was like, I have no idea what a jotter is. So I finally said, I said, Sally, I have no idea what a jotter is. And it ends up being a notepad. And so we're like, oh, okay, you jot stuff down on notepads, so they're jotters. But anyway, that's been a kind of a fun experience dealing with somebody out of the country because I've learned all kinds of new phrases for things. And she's learned a lot of text. She's seen a lot of y'alls, I think, in her email. Yeah. So anyway, that is pretty much the line, all the people that we distribute for right now. But we are, of course, getting ready to start working on our our January market, which is a national TNNA market in, it'll be in Las Vegas. So we're starting to look for at least one or two new artists for that.
When you connect with these artists and convert their stuff to canvas, is there modification or are you as true as you possibly can be to the original piece?
I try to be true, but you do have to, usually you have to get rid of some of the detail because even on 18 count, you're just losing detail. And a lot of their paintings are basically like 20 by 40, you know, 30 by 40 inch canvases that they're creating. And we're trying to not do much over 10 by 12. I had a stitcher that gave me a stitcher model maker, teacher. Her name is Patricia Sohn. She's out of Dallas and she's getting to be very popular. And she actually gave me advice to try not to let any one, at least keep one side at the 10 inch. You don't want to really get too much more than 10 by 12 because then the canvas is too overwhelming. So we try to reduce those 20 by 30 canvases down to a needlepoint canvas that's a design that's maybe 10 by 12. And so you do lose a lot of detail that way, but they still have a lot of detail on them, which is why the stitchers that are a little bit further along really appreciate those designs.
A lot. So you're having each of these stitched then. Do you stitch them yourself and do you have them just filled in or are you having textured stitches added on top or how do you model them?
We don't have all of our designs stitched. I do pass out designs to different stitchers and try to get stitch guides developed for several pieces under each designer. But most of the pieces are just being picked up by teachers and good stitchers and developed into whatever it is they want to do. But several of our pieces are teaching pieces for some of the designers and the teachers that are out there. And yes, all of those pieces lend themselves very well to decorative stitches and textured fibers, very much so.
So when you come up with a canvas then and put it out for sale, you really don't worry about, don't even concern yourself for the most part with having a stitched model then. It's just put it out and let someone else figure it out.
Yes, and the reason is that I only have so much time and so much ability, and even though I am a needle pointer, I don't get to do a lot of needle pointing myself. There's just no time for it. And people like Patricia Sohn or John Waddell or Kathy Calusa, all those people are just way more talented than I probably ever will be. So I let the experts take care of those canvases, and I just work on the basic designs.
Well, and that makes sense, though, because if you're a designer and an artist, then you're doing what you do best, and you're allowing someone else who you believe is doing their best work do that portion of it. So that, I mean, that just sounds efficient.
Yes, yes. And while we do offer stitch guides, stitch guides to me are just a launching point. I would never expect someone to follow a stitch guide to the letter. I, you know, if you're stitching and you don't like the hair stitch that we picked, then, you know, by all means, don't do the bouillon knots. Do French knots or whatever makes you happy. And even on my angels, I just don't believe that you have to stick with what the artist painted. If your daughter has blonde hair and you bought an angel with brown hair, then change the hair to blonde so it looks like your daughter. And, I'm just a big believer in that. I like to see a lot of freedom in the stitching, and I'm real excited about the latest stitching trends where people are, they're just so, by the time they finish, you're just amazed that that's what they came up with from your canvas. You're just I'm astonished half the time when I see some of these pieces on some of the Facebook groups. I'm like, how did they ever think of this? And I'm not there because I don't stitch enough. I'm not there to have that wild creativity and that freedom to do it, but I'm hoping to, I started picking up some, I'm trying to stitch every week now just so that I can kind of get to a place where my mind is more creative and free with the directions that a particular canvas can go.
Yeah, it's too bad, but so many people in your position give up the thing that got them started and the thing that they love,
right,
the actual stitching to be able to do the business. And I mean, it happens in all kinds of businesses like that. You know, photographers, you know, well, I don't take pictures anymore. I don't have time
right,
you know, any number of things. And it's, you know, when you say, I try to stitch once a week, you know, that's most people, you know, I try to not miss a day. And
I'm envious of that. Yeah. It's to the point where, I mean, I literally have to make a choice. Do I want to pull out of my day and go stitch for a couple of hours? Or do I want to get some more shipping done so that my stores are happy and they have customers that are happy? And I usually have to take, that's the route that I will take 95% of the time. The only day that I don't work is on Sundays, and I come home from, we go to church. My husband's a minister, so we go to church on Sunday. And when we come home, I tend to throw on yoga pants or whatever. I wash my face. And I go into our bedroom and I watch Netflix or PBS all day long in my room. And so that has kind of become where I've turned it into my stitching spot. I do other crafts as well, but the needlepoint, I do that as well. My two cats come in and hang out with me, and we're there for hours, and it's just it's my downtime, and it's really the only downtime I have all week because I pretty much work a 60-hour a week. And if I run errands or something on Saturday, half those errands have something to do with my business. You know, I've got to pick up some kind of paper for the office, or I've got to buy some decoration for the next market, you know, things like that. So there's not a lot of just hanging out time. There's always something back there that needs my attention. And but I do take Sundays off. That's just my one day to kind of de-stress a little bit.
So how does Destination Dallas fit into this? How did that come to be? I mean, you got a full-blown business. Doesn't seem like you need to have a trade show on top of it, but
yeah.
And I will tell you that when we get hot and heavy into planning Dallas, that is another, that it's become, it literally is like I've got two full-time jobs going at the same time, and we can work a 70-hour week easy during that time. And I do, and my Painted Pony sometimes gets a little bit put on the back burner because I've got Painted Pony, but I've also got, at this last market, we had 172 shops and we had 117 vendors. So you have almost 300 people that depend on you to do a good job with that market. So sometimes the Painted Pony suffers a little bit, but most of my stores have come to understand that over the years, and they're usually pretty good and pretty understanding. But when I get back from that market, they're all like calling me like, okay, are you shipping now? And I'm like, yes, I promise not to sleep for the next 3 weeks until I get it all shipped. Anyway, Destination Dallas started when was 9/11? That was in 2001. So it started in the spring of 2001. We had an April show, and it was that same old Destination Dallas market that I had talked about earlier. And, it was owned by a lady out of Colorado named Evelyn Waldman. She had been doing this show and other shows for years, but she had finally just, the Alice Show was the only show left that she was producing. And she talked to Karen McVean from Strictly Christmas about taking that market over. And Karen was like, she knew that she didn't want to do the whole thing herself. So she looked around and found a couple of other people to help her out. And she came and asked me, and we really didn't know each other very well. But we were, you know, fairly local. We lived about 2 hours away from Dallas. And it ended up, like I said, I didn't know Karen very well. And after working with her for years, she's one of my most dearest friends. And we've worked on this, I think we've been 17 years now in the business. But I will tell you that the first year, like I said, we picked up the market right after the April show and started planning for the 2002 market. And then September 11th happened. And we were just like, oh, my goodness. You know, what is that? I mean, people are afraid to fly. They're afraid of terrorists. They're afraid. You know, they're afraid. And what are we going to do? So we kind of were a little bit cautious putting on that first show. And I think we had it in February of 2002, February, March, somewhere in there. However, we did really well. We went from the previous year when it was a destination, when it was the Dallas Needlework Market, had 29 vendors and 31 shops. And we went from that to having about 63 vendors and maybe 75 shops. So we just about doubled everything. And so ended up as a really good start. And it's grown every year since. We really have not had any years where we lost shops. It's always been, sometimes it's just two or three more than we had last year, you know, that kind of a thing. But it's continued to grow. What our goal had been is that we didn't want to lose the little regional market that was in our backyard. And it was just an important market for, there were a lot of Texas artists at the time and a lot of shops at the time in Texas. And so we wanted to keep that market going just so that we had that one venue to sell to our local regional area. Well, what happened is after a few years, you realize that if you keep it regional, you're not going to grow. There's only so many shops to sell to. There's only so many artists that will come. So we made a very concerted effort to start trying to attract shops from all over the country, because if the shops come, the designers will come.
Right.
And we ended up now, I would say that the Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, Arkansas shops are probably less than 15% or 20% of who comes. Most of our buyers are actually jumping on a plane and coming. And that's the ticket to a good market, because they're not going to spend all that money to travel if they're not going to do some serious purchasing once they get to your market. But anyway, I'm real proud of it. It's a hard thing to do. It's a hard thing to put on every year. I've told my partner Karen, I said, when my daughter ever gets married, that will be a breeze compared to putting on. I mean, it will take nothing. It'll be just, I could do that in my sleep, because putting on this show is a massive undertaking. We have a huge banquet that usually about 150, 160 people attend, and we have entertainment during that banquet. We have a welcome party, and that's where we have a DJ, and we have dancing and free food. We give free food and drinks out that night. This year we added a excursion, I guess I'll call it. It was a little bus trip over to a very popular Italian restaurant that most of our designers and some of our buyers have loved for years. It's over in a location where we used to have Destination Dallas. We moved to a new hotel 2 years ago because we outgrew the hotel that we were in. And then we have classes, and every year we run somewhere between 15 to 17 classes, and those are divided up into three different categories. We have resource classes, and those are your kind of your business type classes. This year, for example, we had a photographer that talked about photo staging. We had we had another guy come and talk about social media. We always run a resource class that's called Needlepoint 101, and that is a class for brand new stores or stores that have been in business for less than 5 years. And every year that may attract 5 to 6, 7 shops, but it is a very – it's a wonderful class. They get to – the moderator is a friend of mine named Susan Burris, and she has a really nice packet of information, and they just talk, and they talk about whatever issues they that are worrying them or that they've got concerns or want to know about. And so it's a very fluid and organic class. It changes from year to year. So we allow our new shop owners to take that 5 years. Then after 5 years, we figure you know what you're doing and you need to move on out of that class and go prove that we taught you everything that you need to know. I don't know. But anyway, and then we have another group of classes, and that is called our technique classes. And those are usually an unpainted canvas, but it's a teacher like a Tony Manieri or a Laura Taylor or Amy Bunger. Let me see, who else do we have? They come in and they teach you some kind of a technique. It might be a hair technique, like how to do some different kinds of hair, how to do some different kinds of embellishments. And anyway, so we have that, and we usually run about 4 or 5 of those. And then the last group is your more traditional canvas classes. We ask each teacher to come up with 2 or 3 very innovative techniques that the stores can take back and teach in their own shops. And hopefully the exposure that the teacher gets and the exposure that the designer gets will result in classes, you know, for that canvas or that series of canvases to be taught in the store, or hopefully have that teacher come in and teach, you know, travel somewhere and teach. And so those are kind of the goals of the classes, to expose teachers and designers to our stores. We try to make sure we always have a couple of new designers that they are unfamiliar with and offer their classes as offer their canvases as classes. Anyway, so we anyway, that is another segment of our market. And then, of course, is the traditional floor trade show, which is done in a hotel setting. We are set up in a suite-style hotel, and so everybody takes their little room. They might use their front room and their bedroom, or they may just use their front room, and they set up their displays inside the hotel, and then the shops just walk around. It's an atrium-style hotel, so they you know, walk through the around the atrium and up on the different floors and do their traditional shopping that they would do, like if they were at a large trade show.
So, but the neat thing here, I didn't realize all this went on. You're really helping stores develop their business as much as you are just selling them canvases.
Yes, yes, through the education, yes. And the other thing that I didn't mention that's really important that is that because we're a small show, and it's kind of like a little more like it's more intimate, I think, than when you're on a trade show floor. And the shops actually get to know each other. And I've watched over the years as shop owners have become real good friends. And they're making plans to meet in Dallas because they're going to go do whatever they're going to do and, you know, go out and eat and go have fun. And I've just seen a lot of networking between the shops as well as between the designers in the shops. And I think it serves a really good purpose. It keeps, we're a small industry. We're not computers where you just walk into, you know, and look at somebody's keyboards and decide, well, I'll buy, you know, 10 of those or whatever. It's more of a one-on-one relationship. Most of my shop owners, I mean, I know whether they have kids. I know if their kids went off to college. I know, I just know a lot about them. And then, of course, they know a lot about us, the designers. Everyone has watched my daughter grow up. She used to attend the old Dallas market with us when she was just, 4, 5, 6 years old. She used to take her little Barbies and her model horses and hide underneath the skirted tables and play under there. And people would come in the room and they could hear her talking and they'd be like, what is that? Like, that's my little girl. Anyway, and so she's grown up with us through the business, and she, you know, she now comes to market and is, takes orders and things for us as well. So she's grown up and helps us out now. And she's also working on our new website. We have a website we're trying to launch next month, and she's helped design the basics for that. Anyway, so the networking, like I said, yeah. is really a key part component, I think, to the markets. And like I said, we try to make our markets really fun. We want the whole experience. We want you to go home and just be happy, happy, happy that you went to Destination Dallas. And I think it's been successful. One of the key things that we do is that we have a theme every year. And we've had a lot of themes. Last year we had a cowboy theme because it was our – we just had moved back to the hotel that we had started out in, and the first year that we were at that hotel, we had had a Western theme. So we repeated, this is the only time we've ever repeated a theme, but we've had cruise themes and Alice in the Wonderland themes and stuff. We always tailor it to, you know, to some kind of a stitching thing. So, you know, it was basically like Alice in Wonderland was basically Alice in Stitcherland and that kind of stuff. And this year's theme was called Stitching on the Orient Express. And so we had a mystery during the banquet, and we, you know, everybody was into trains, and we had a lot of great props that we rented and spread around the hotel. You know, we had Eiffel Towers and the English little phone booths and because we kind of covered three countries. We covered England and Italy and France is kind of where we took all our decorating cues from, because the Orient Express train goes through those three countries. And next year, we're real excited. My partner and I are very excited about next year. We're going to be doing a 1960s theme, and we're already planning to wear hippie clothes every day. and I've been telling everyone, and don't take this wrong, but they were like, what kind of food are you going to serve for your banquet? I said, I don't know. I'm going to have brownies for dessert.
Well, obviously.
Yeah. Obviously. But anyway, I just think that market's going to be really fun. When we did the cowboy thing last year, we had a lot of people show up wearing, like, they had actually bought cowboy boots to wear to market and hats. So I think that this year or next year in 2018, they will also get really into the whole theme of it and come dressed as hippies, and we'll have hippies everywhere. It'll be great.
That sounds like fun.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So you just...
It just adds a little layer of craziness to the whole thing, which is fun.
So the this year's just finished, not just last week or the week before.
I came home one weekend, so I came home. I got home a week ago Wednesday. Or a week ago today. I got home a week ago today.
What trends did you see in terms of what people had to offer? More smaller canvases, more detailed things. What were you seeing in terms of what was offered?
I think that we're seeing trends in a lot of detail. Like I said, with the designers that I've been bringing into my line, they're heavily detailed. I'm seeing a lot of that. The stitchers seem to really crave that. I'm seeing a lot of bigger canvases. There was a period of time where everyone was saying you should design small because the economy, you know, people can't go out and afford some of these larger canvases. But I'm seeing a trend back to those larger canvases. I'm seeing a lot of fantastic finishing. Finishing has just gone in directions that we would never have imagined 10 years ago. When I first started, I mean, you stitched an ornament and you took it down to the shop and they backed it with velvet and put a cord around it and a hanger and you were good to go. That was all there was. That would just be almost the saddest thing you ever saw. I mean, these things are amazing. There's just amazing, amazing finishing out there, turning things into things that you just would not have believed. And there was a nice little company from Arkansas called Du Bijou Bijou that was at our show, and they were doing a lot of trays and different wooden things, and they weren't just that traditional flat tray. These things had crazy legs on them and tons of layers and all kinds of wild painting, and they will actually customize their trays to the design that you want to put into the canvas. So that was a cool little company.
That does sound interesting, because that's something we've talked about before, where there's only so many pillows or things you hang on the wall before, you know, okay, what do I do with this now? You know, how do you make it useful?
Exactly. I mean, pillows and framed pieces they're here to stay because they're just classic and they work. But there's so many other things people are doing with needlepoint now. We're seeing more and more wearable needlepoint designs. You know, everybody is familiar with a belt, and that people have seen shoes, but you're starting to see them in inserts on bags and purses, and a lot of people are doing purse designs, and they are just, you know, they're every bit as beautiful as some Dooney and Book purse down at Dillard's. They are just gorgeous. And yeah, and I really lust after some of those purses, but I don't have time to stitch them. And anyway, and you're seeing some inserts into jackets and things like that. And it's nice to see needlepoint going into a lot of different directions. And it helps to attract the younger crowd as well. When it's not just a stuffy little rose on a pillow, it is, you know, it's now a pillow inserted into the back of your vest or something. It's cool.
Yeah, and we need to attract that younger set. So, yeah, any of that stuff helps.
Right. We do, and in fact, that was one of the things that we have. The industry overall is very, you know, is very in tune with how do we get the younger people into stitching. You know, kids nowadays and young people, 20, 30-year-olds, millennials in that group, they're all on their computers and they're all on their iPhones and they're not looking up and they're not picking up a needle and thread and doing tradition. They're not carrying the traditions on. And it's a concern because we want this thing that we love so much to continue many generations past when we're out of this business. And there are some new designers that are coming in and, you know, me being almost, I'm still in my 50s, but I won't be there long. And I, you know, sometimes I don't quite get some of the newer stuff, but it's exciting that they're doing it because what they're designing is having some big appeal in those millennial age kids. And there was a interview that I watched that was done at Destination Dallas, and it was with a lady named Holly who works for Rittenhouse. Rittenhouse is a needlepoint store in Philadelphia. And she was talking about some of the new designers and the things they do. And she says that they'll stitch something and then they'll just shred the edges and they'll pin it on to a jacket. And I was like, okay.
That's kind of interesting though.
But they're doing it and that's what we want, you know. So if it involves into things that we're not accustomed to seeing, I mean, good for them. Good for the designer that thought of that and great for the young people that look at needlepoint and see it in ways that we cannot imagine, you know, before. And anyway, to the end, I was going to tell you about a speaker that we had come to Destination Dallas. We had heard on Facebook that there was a young girl named Jenny Huff, and she is a math teacher in Lakewood, California. And I had seen a Facebook post on Jenny, and it was talking about her class, and it was talking about her club that she had in her high school. Now, who would think that a high school anywhere would have a club for needlepoint? But she had already had about 60 kids in that club by the time we found out about her. So I had gone up to a meeting in Dallas and with my partner and her sister, and we were brainstorming, like, what could we do that would be different for Destination Dallas? And I said, you know what? I just saw this post on this young teacher, and she's got like 60 kids in her high school that are needlepointing. And they're like, you have got to be kidding. And I'm like, no, it's for real. And so in about 30 minutes, we found out who she was, and we contacted her school, and then she called us back, and what we had decided in that time we were waiting is that we would invite her to Destination Dallas and present her with our award. We gave her, we created an award called Pointing to the Future, and the purpose of that award is we give it to her and as we give it to people in the future is for people who are doing innovative things that are pushing needlepoint into the future and creating a love of needlepoint among the younger people. And so Jenny was a perfect fit for that. So created that award for her, and then we invited her to come over. We invited her for the whole weekend, and she brought her husband. And then while she was there, she teamed up with Bonnie Cody, whose mother, Sherry, owns Needlepoint This in Dallas. She and Bonnie teamed up to make one of our resource classes, and it was called Kids Camps and Clubs and how to get kids involved in it. Anyway, Jenny had a very nice presentation. She had a slideshow and a little video at the end, and it was just off. She was a wonderful speaker. She was one of the most confident young women I have ever seen. She did a beautiful job in her presentation. And anyway, her club is about, it's over, she told me recently that her club is now over 75 kids. And wow. That about half of those kids are boys, which is amazing because mm-hmm. the young people, you know, they don't know that, boys don't know that they're not supposed to need a point. They just think, hey, I'll do this too, you know. And so, and that's what you want. You want the guys to be needle pointing, but, you know, there's just been such a stigma against it over the years. So we're, you know, it's exciting to see these young people without any restraints trying to learn how to needlepoint, and they're encouraging each other. And she said the purpose of the needlepoint club was for the kids to come into her class and put their phones down and get away from technology for 35 minutes. They do it during their lunch breaks and de-stress and do something creative, you know, because a lot of the art programs are gone from schools and things right. like that. And anyway, she has really, this has just been wildly successful. And last year she told me that a couple of her boys that were in her class were football players. So, you know, it's a lot of different kinds of kids taking needlepoint and using it as a way to relax. And she did say in her presentation that one of the exciting parts that was exciting for me and for other shop owners was to hear that these kids are graduating and going into needlepoint shops and buying projects. And, yes, if you can do it in one school, Lakewood, California, imagine what you could do all over the country and how many people, both boys and girls, men and women, would be interested in the art that we love so much.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. That's a great story. Yep. Mm-hmm. Terrific. Debbie, we got to end this thing. Oh, this has been an absolute treat. Thanks for doing this.
Oh, thank you
so much more. Yeah.
I would have much to say, but I guess once you get a text and started talking, stop.
No, I'm fascinated by the idea of the show because it's so different not having you know, consumers or needle pointers there and having it just be a business show. The idea of that is just fascinating to me.
Yes, but you got, you know, all stores, no matter what they are, whether they sell clothes or toys,
yep.
you know, all
we go did to the same thing. Stuff. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It makes sense.
Yes. Anyway, I would love it if y'all came down, and maybe spent some time with us next year and did some of your podcasts from there.
We may just have to work that out. Yep. That would be fun.
I think we can.
It would be great. You would love it. Yep. I know my partner would love it as well.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to end it right here. Debbie, thanks so much for making time to tell us about all these things and give us some insight into Painted Pony and Destination Dallas. Really enjoyed it. Thanks to everybody for listening, and Christine and I will be back on Wednesday.
Thanks. Take care.